Welcome back, dear friends. We're in chapter 9, Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta. So, Sri Aurobindo, in this chapter on the Yoga of the Intelligent Will, pardon me, not Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta, it is chapter 10, is looking at what it is that makes us one-pointed, that brings us into union with the divine. And in a way, there's a recapitulation here of the teachings which were prevalent in the few Upanishads who were in circulation in those years. The idea of governing oneself, of pulling oneself in, reining in the senses, controlling the mind, and focusing on the things that were essentially important, as a kurma, as a tortoise might do, drawing itself within its shell. But the idea of this kind of dharana, this kind of concentration, was not exclusive of action, not even in the Upanishads. The Upanishads have the seekers fasten themselves to this kind of practice, but then they are released back into action in the world, having learned essential spiritual lessons. They are not kept as anchorites in the forest. They are sent back, missioned into the world. So the Gita, of course, is well known for its active poise in the practice of yoga, that whether you know or whether you love, you must pour yourself out in consecrated action. Gnostic, uplifted, devotional, but still engaging in the work of the world. So we take up Sri Aurobindo's argument after he's made some of these points, focusing almost entirely here in chapter 2. It is not, when I say chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, it is not an external asceticism, the physical renunciation of the objects of sense that I am teaching, suggests Krishna, immediately to avoid a misunderstanding which is likely at once to arise. Now we're going on a long session here. This is going to be second chapter, shlokas 58 to 68. I wonder if it would be profitable to just read those. Why don't we? Remember where we were in the shloka above when we left last time. Who draws away the senses from the objects of sense? As the tortoise draws in his limbs into the shell, his intelligence sits firmly founded in wisdom. If one abstains from food, the objects of sense cease to affect, but the affection itself of the sense, the rasa, remains. The rasa also ceases when the Supreme is seen. Even the mind of the wise, who labors for perfection, is carried away by the vehement insistence of the senses, O son of Kunti. Having brought all the senses under control, he must sit firm in yoga, wholly given up to me. For whose senses are mastered, of him the intelligence is firmly established. In him whose mind dwells on the objects of sense with absorbing interest, attachment to them is formed. From attachment arises desire. From desire, anger comes forth. Anger leads to bewilderment. From bewilderment comes loss of memory. And by that, the intelligence is destroyed. From destruction of intelligence, he perishes. It is by ranging over the objects with the senses, but with senses subject to the self, freed from liking and disliking, that one gets into a large and sweet clearness of soul and temperament in which passion and grief find no place. The intelligence of such a man is rapidly established. For one who is not in yoga, there is no intelligence, no concentration of thought. For him, without concentration, there is no peace. And for the unpeaceful, how can there be happiness? Such of the roving senses as the mind follows, that carries away the understanding, just as the winds carry away a ship on the sea. Therefore, O mighty armed, one who has utterly restrained the excitement of the senses by their objects, his intelligence sits firmly founded in calm self-knowledge. That which is to all creatures a night is to the self-mastering sage his waking. The life of the dualities, which is to them their waking, is a night to the sage who sees. He attains peace, into whom all desires enter as waters into the sea, which is ever being filled, yet ever motionless, not he who is disturbed by every little inrush of desire. He who abandons all desires and lives and acts free from longing, who has no I or mine, he attains to the great peace. This is Brahmisthiti, O son of Pritha. Having attained thereto, one is not bewildered. Fixed in that status at his end, one can attain to extinction in the Brahman. So that's 58 all the way up to 72, the end of the chapter, is translated by Sri Aurobindo, and we will meet many of those same passages rendered here in the next couple of pages. So, back to our text, and let's start again, shall we? It is not an external asceticism, the physical renunciation of the objects of sense that I am teaching, suggests Krishna immediately to avoid a misunderstanding which is likely at once to arise. Again, he is never going to teach sannyasa. He will teach tyaga. Sannyasa is the external renunciation. I will not conduct myself like this. But tyaga is the inner detachment, the self-sufficiency of the soul inside. They are different things. Maybe the one is necessary to a few to prepare for the inner detachment, the tyaga, but without tyaga, sannyasa is fruitless. Not the renunciation of the sankhyas or the austerities of the rigid ascetic with his fasts, his maceration of the body, his attempt to abstain even from food. That is not the self-discipline or the abstinence which I mean, for I speak of an inner withdrawal, a renunciation of desire. Maceration, from Latin, macerare, to steep, like you steep a bag of tea. So it means to wear down, to attenuate, as if by fasting, the body becomes thinner and thinner and thinner. That's what he means here, the maceration of the body, the wasting away of the body. The embodied soul, having a body, has to support it normally by food for its normal physical action. By abstention from food, by abstention from food, it simply removes from itself the physical contact with the object of sense, but does not get rid of the inner relation which makes that contact hurtful, because it leads to attachment. It retains the pleasure of the sense in the object, the rasa, the liking and disliking, for rasa has two sides. The soul must, on the contrary, be capable of enduring the physical contact without suffering inwardly this sensuous reaction. Otherwise, there is nivritti, cessation of the object, vishaya vinivartante, that's 259, but no subjective cessation, no nivritti of the mind. So you can cease to contact the object, but that doesn't mean that there's not a subtle attachment, a mental attachment. But the senses are of the mind, subjective, and subjective cessation of the rasa is the only real sign of mastery. But how is this desireless contact with objects, this unsensuous use of the senses, possible? It is possible, param drishtva, by the vision of the Supreme, the Purusha. Param, the soul, the Purusha, and by living in the yoga, in union or oneness of the whole subjective being with that, through the yoga of the intelligence, buddhi yoga. For the one soul is calm, satisfied in its own delight. And that delight, free from duality, can take, once we see this supreme thing in us, and fix the mind and will on that, the place of the sensuous, object-ridden pleasures and repulsions of the mind. This is the true way of liberation. So all the being reined in and focused on what is essentially true. It doesn't mean the abandonment of the whole chain of being, from the intelligence downward, from buddhi through manas into the objects of the senses and the senses themselves and all of that business. No, it means that you are fixed in the power and the presence of the soul. The one soul, calm, satisfied in its own delight. Later in the Gita at 3:17, describes the self, the Atman, as Atma Rati, delighting in its own nature. This is the true way of liberation. Certainly, self-discipline, self-control is never easy. All intelligent human beings know that they must exercise some control over themselves, and nothing is more common than this advice to control the senses. But ordinarily, it is only advised imperfectly and practiced imperfectly in the most limited and insufficient fashion. Even, however, the sage, the man of clear, wise, and discerning soul, 260, who really labors to acquire complete self-mastery finds himself hurried and carried away by the senses. That is because the mind naturally lends itself to the senses, 2, 62, and 63. It observes the objects of sense with an inner interest, settles upon them, and makes them the object of absorbing thought for the intelligence and of strong interest for the will. By that, attachment comes. By attachment, desire. By desire, distress, passion, and anger, when the desire is not satisfied, or is thwarted or opposed. And by passion, the soul is obscured. The intelligence and will forget to see and be seated in the calm, observing soul. There is a fall from the memory of one's true self, and by that lapse, the intelligent will is also obscured, destroyed even. Again, that's the buddhi. So we can see that this outward-going identification with the experience that the senses bring to us, then with the senses themselves, then with the objects of the senses, is leading us away from the deep and into the shallow, into the superficial, into the external, the merely formal. And in reference to the sage, who, even though wiser than the lot, still can be carried away by the senses, let's have a look forward to chapter 4 in Shloka 17, Gahana Karmano Gatihi. Thick and tangled is the way of works, deep and impenetrable. So, even the sage will stumble in this because it is impenetrable. It is dark. And yet, the sage will recover, will get back into the space of the soul and find his way, light the path again. But capable of making an error? Anybody who owns a human body, anybody who resides on this planet, is capable of error. And we all prove it abundantly. For the time being, it no longer exists to our memory of ourselves. It disappears in a cloud of passion. We become passion, wrath, grief, and cease to be self and intelligence and will. This, then, must be prevented, and all the senses brought utterly under control. For only by an absolute control of the senses can the wise and calm intelligence be firmly established in its proper seat. So this movement outward is also a movement downward. Remember the scale of being that the Sankhyas describes to us, similar to what the Gita will say in a while about the Ashwatha tree, whose roots are above and whose branches extend below. Above is where the great source of nature is, and then extends itself outward and downward. And if we begin to identify with the downward moving aspects of nature, then we wind up in a wrong identification with what is not essentially self. So we have to turn that around. Katha Upanishad, Shvetashvatara Upanishad, etc., are calling us back and back and back to that. This cannot be done perfectly by the act of the intelligence itself, by a merely mental self-discipline. It can only be done by yoga, with something which is higher than itself, and in which calm and self-mastery are inherent. So he's talking here, higher than itself. So this is a yoga that fastens upon us and lifts us up. And this yoga can only arrive at its success by devoting, by consecrating, by giving up the whole self to the divine, to me, says Krishna. For the liberator is within us all, but it is not our mind, nor our intelligence, nor our personal will. They are only instruments. So this is 261, devoting, bhakti yoga, consecrating, karma yoga, giving up the whole self to the divine. That is jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge, the yoga of works, the yoga of bhakti, all lead to identification with that, with the one true being, Purusha. The Supreme sits in you as the Purusha that you can come to know. But it is also the Supreme Purusha, Purushottama. Yeah. And this is the upward way. We describe the downward way leading us to gross identification with the objects of the world. Now, this is the upward way, turning it around, going back. That is what yoga is. It is the Lord in whom, as we are told in the end, we have utterly to take refuge. 1866. And for that, we must at first make him the object of our whole being, and keep in soul contact with him. This is the sense of the phrase, he must sit firm in yoga, wholly given up to me, 261 again. But as yet, it is the merest passing hint after the manner of the Gita, three words only, which contain in seed the whole gist of the highest secret yet to be developed. Yukta asita matparaha, 261. Intent on me. Matparaha. Intent on me. Focused on him. If this is done, then it becomes possible to move among the objects of sense, in contact with them, acting on them, but with the senses entirely under the control of the subjective self, not at the mercy of the objects and their contacts and reactions, and that self again, obedient to the highest self, the Purusha. So moving among the objects of sense, but identified only with that one supreme being. And this takes us back to the Taittiriya Upanishad 3.10.5, where it's described that one moves through the world, experiencing that, experiencing this, free. The eater eating is eaten. All is the play of delight. The transformation of form is not confusing, because it is only that, that single essential being which we meet in experience after experience after experience, and in the delight of whom we can offer that being back to itself, saying, look, I have found you here. Aren't you wonderful? There. Then, free from reactions, the senses will be delivered from the affections of liking and disliking, 264 and 265, escape the duality of positive and negative desire, and calm, peace, clearness, happy tranquility, Atma Prasada, will settle upon the man. Prasanna Chaitasaha. That clear tranquility is the source of the soul's felicity. All grief begins to lose its power of touching the tranquil soul. The intelligence is rapidly established in the peace of the self. Suffering is destroyed. It is this calm, desireless, griefless fixity of the Buddhi in self-poise and self-knowledge to which the Gita gives the name of samadhi. You can have a look at 1837 for some assonance. The sign of the man in samadhi is not that he loses consciousness of objects and surroundings and of his mental and physical self and cannot be recalled to it even by burning or torture of the body, the ordinary idea of the matter. Trance is a particular intensity, not the essential sign. But we have, from the measuring criteria of the higher stages of meditative practice in Buddhism, in Advaita Vedanta, leading up even to modern times with Sri Ramakrishna and Sri Ramana Maharshi, a kind of fascination with the capacity of the soul who can place himself in that state of consciousness and become oblivious to anything else, can be dead to the senses and to that life. That is not essentially what we're talking about. Sri Aurobindo returns. The test is the expulsion of all desires, their inability to get at the mind. And it is the inner state from which this freedom arises, the delight of the soul gathered within itself, which the mind equal and still and high poised above the attractions and repulsions, the alternations of sunshine and storm and stress of the external life. It is drawn inward even when acting outwardly. It is concentrated in self even when gazing out upon things. It is directed wholly to the divine even when to the outward vision of others busy and preoccupied with the affairs of the world. Reminds us of the image of Nataraja, inwardly absorbed while conducting all the business, the creation, the maintenance, even the destruction of the entire universe. Arjuna, voicing the average human mind, asks from some outward, physical, practically discernible sign of this great samadhi, how does such a man speak, how sit, how walk? 254. No such signs can be given, nor does the teacher attempt to supply them. For the only possible test of its possession is inward, and that there are plenty of hostile psychological forces to apply. Equality is the great stamp of the liberated soul, and of that equality, even the most discernible signs are still subjective. Samatvam, Samatha, 248. So those who look from outside, wanting to see, is the sage really settled in mind? Has he attained in equality, samatha? It is not perceptible. You won't know. Even should the sensory matter react and respond, that doesn't tell you about the inner condition of the sage. Huh. Equality, again, is the great stamp of the liberated soul. And of that equality, even the most discernible signs are still subjective. A man with mind untroubled by sorrows, who has done with desire for pleasures, from whom liking and wrath and fear have passed away, such is the sage whose understanding has become founded in stability. That's 256. He is without the triple action of the qualities of Prakriti, Trigunya Vishaya. That's 245. I'll read it again. He is without the triple action of the qualities of Prakriti, without the dualities, ever based in his true being, without getting or having, possessed of his self, Atmavan. 245. For what gettings and havings has the free soul? Once we are possessed of the self, we are in possession of all things. Again, Taittiriya Upanishad 3.10.5. And yet, he does not cease from work and action. There is the originality and power of the Gita, that having affirmed this static condition, this superiority to nature, this emptiness even of all that constitutes ordinarily the action of nature for the liberated soul, it is still able to vindicate for it, to enjoin on it even the continuance of works, and thus avoid the great defect of the merely quietistic and ascetic philosophies, the defect from which we find them today attempting to escape. You might be aware that as Sri Aurobindo was beginning to call everyone back to an active and dynamic yoga, India began to reawaken and say, wait, but that's also in Shankara, that's also in Advaita Vedanta, etc. It's all been misinterpreted. Very well. Thou hast a right to action, but only to action, never to its fruits. Let not the fruits of thy works be thy motive, neither let there be in thee any attachment to inactivity. 247. Ma palishu, inactivity, akarmani. Therefore, it is not the works practiced with desire by the Vedavadins, it is not the claim for the satisfaction of the restless and energetic mind by a constant activity, the claim made by the practical or the kinetic man, which is here enjoined. In other words, if there's justification for karma yoga, it isn't this. Fixed in yoga, do thy actions. Having abandoned attachment, having become equal in failure and success. For it is equality that is meant by yoga. Chapter 2, Shloka 48. Fixed in yoga, work. Yogastaha kuru. Equality is yoga. Samatvam yogaha uchyate. Action is distressed by the choice between a relative good and evil, the fear of sin, and the difficult endeavor towards virtue. But the liberated, who has united his reason and will with the divine, casts away from him, even here in this world of dualities, both good doing and evil doing. For he rises to a higher law beyond good and evil. founded in the liberty of self-knowledge. Such desireless action, nishkama karma, can have no decisiveness, no effectiveness, no efficient motive, no large or vigorous creative power? Not so. Action done in yoga is not only the highest, but the wisest, the most potent and efficient, even for the affairs of the world. For it is informed by the knowledge and will of the master of works. Yoga is skill in works. Yogaha karmasu kaushalam. 250. But all action directed towards life leads away from the universal aim of the yogin, which is, by common consent, to escape from bondage to this distressed and sorrowful human birth? Not so either. The sages who do works without desire for fruits and in yoga with the divine are liberated from the bondage of birth and reach that other perfect status in which there are none of the maladies which afflict the mind and life of a suffering humanity. The status he reaches is the Brahmic condition. He gets to firm standing in the Brahman, Brahmi Stiti, 272. It is a reversal of the whole view, experience, knowledge, values, seeings of earthbound creatures. This life of the dualities, which is to them their day, their waking, their consciousness, their bright condition of activity and knowledge, is to him a night, a troubled sleep and darkness of the soul. That higher being, which is to them a night, a sleep in which all knowledge and will cease, is to the self-mastering sage his waking, his luminous day of true being, knowledge and power. 268 through 70. They are troubled and muddy waters disturbed by every little inrush of desire. He is an ocean of wide being and consciousness, which is ever being filled, yet ever motionless in its large poise of his soul. All the desires of the world enter into him as waters into the sea, yet he has no desire, nor is troubled. 270. For while they are filled with the troubling sense of ego and mine and thine, he is one with the one self in all and has no I or mine. He acts as others, but he has abandoned all desires and their longings. He attains to the great peace and is not bewildered by the shows of things. He has extinguished his individual ego in the One, lives in that unity, and fixed in that status at his end, can attain to extinction in the Brahman, nirvana. Not the negative self-annihilation of the Buddhists, but the great emergence of the separate personal self into the vast reality of the one infinite impersonal existence. Brahma Nirvanam. All this, chapter 2, shlokas 71 and 2. And that, of course, describes Sri Aurobindo's first spiritual realization in Baroda in 1908. And he immediately, as it were, returned to the field and took up his work for the liberation of India from servitude to the British crown. Such subtly unifying Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta is the first foundation of the teaching of the Gita. It is far from being all, but it is the first indispensable practical unity of knowledge and works, with a hint already of the third crowning intensest element in the soul's completeness, divine love and devotion. The great peace, Shantim Adigachati. May that very peace come to you. So, to Savitri from the Bhagavad Gita. Let's read from Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, and Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release, and I think... I think we begin on page 42. A vision lightened on the viewless heights, a wisdom illumined from the voiceless depths, a deeper interpretation greatened truth, a grand reversal of the night and day. All the world's values changed, heightening life's aim. A wiser word, a larger thought came in than what the slow labor of human mind can bring. A secret sense awoke that could perceive a presence and a greatness everywhere. The universe was not now this senseless whirl, born round inert on an immense machine. It cast away its grandiose, lifeless front, a mechanism no more or work of chance, but a living movement of the body of God. A spirit hid in forces and in forms was the spectator of the mobile scene. The beauty and the ceaseless miracle let in a glow of the unmanifest. The formless everlasting moved in it, seeking its own perfect form in souls and things. Life kept no more a dull and meaningless shape. In the struggle and upheaval of the world, he saw the labor of a Godhead's birth. A secret knowledge masked as ignorance. Fate covered with an unseen necessity, the game of chance of an omnipotent will. A glory and a rapture and a calm, pardon me, a glory and a rapture and a charm, the all-blissful sat unknown within the heart. Earth's pains were the ransom of its prisoned delight. A glad communion tinged the passing hours. The days were travelers on a destined road, the nights companions of his musing spirit. A heavenly impetus quickened all his breast. The trudge of time changed to a splendid march. The divine dwarf towered to unconquered worlds. Earth grew too narrow for his victory. once only registering the heavy tread of a blind power on human littleness, life now became a sure approach to God, existence a divine experiment, and cosmos the soul's opportunity. The world was a conception and a birth of spirit in matter into living forms, and nature bore the immortal in her womb that she might climb through him to eternal life. His being lay down in bright immobile peace and bathed in wells of pure spiritual light. It wandered in wide fields of wisdom self, lit by the rays of an everlasting sun. Even his body's subtle self within could raise the earthly parts towards higher things and feel on it the breath of heavenlier air. Already it journeyed towards divinity, a buoyed upon winged winds of rapid joy, upheld to a light it could not always hold. It left mind's distance from the truth supreme and lost life's incapacity for bliss. All now suppressed in us began to emerge. So, namaste. Good to see you all.